Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Couple Speak Relationship Forum on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist and relationship coach at the Couple Center and Couple Speak in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I broadcast live each month, usually on Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m. Tonight, I'm here at a different time and night for a very special one-hour show with Ashley Davis Bush, author of the recently published 75 Habits for a Happy Marriage. Ashley co-authored this gem of a book with her husband, Daniel, after together they developed and tested the ideas in their own marriage and in their clients' marriages with much success. Ashley and I will be discussing the habits and welcome any questions or comments you may have throughout the show. To join us live, just dial 1 on your phone and you'll be in line to come on the air. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Susan. It's great to be here talking with you.
I'm so happy to have you here. I have so been enjoying the book, as have my clients. And it must be very exciting for you, this book, just recently published.
Yes, it is recently published, and I'm just thrilled when I hear that it's helping couples and that people can use the habits and really digest the material in a way that improves their lives. It's just a great honor for me.
Yeah, I'm getting great feedback from anybody who's bought it and used the book. And you know what strikes me is that this is the first book that you've co-authored. You co-authored it with your husband, Daniel. Haven't your other books been just you writing them?
Well, they have, although I would say Shortcuts to Inner Peace, which was my third book, Daniel really helped me a lot with that one. He was my editor, and he sort of helped me develop some of the ideas and streamline things. So this one, we did a similar kind of collaboration, but he got his name on the book. So he deserves
great.
To be honored for that.
Yeah, and you know what? It really made it come alive more, I think, the fact that you could talk personally about some of your experiences together.
Yes.
I think it really made some of the habits and the exercises hit home in a way for couples that it might not have if you were only talking about clients. It really added a nice personal touch. In any event,
well, good.
Yeah, this book is based, part of what I like about it is that the book is based on data from research and from real science. You drew from neuroscience, attachment theory, cognitive therapy, mind-body techniques, all kinds of stuff. And you focus on habits to maintain and enhance connection, communication, and intimacy. And I'm wondering, Ashley, if you could tell our listeners a little bit about the premise of the book and how you chose those particular aspects of marriage to focus on.
Okay. Well, I would love to. I just love to talk about this entire subject because I passionately believe that most couples can be happier than they currently are and that we really live in a society that threatens to pull us apart. We're all so busy. We get so distracted and wrapped up in our careers and our families and raising children and doing all the to-do lists and errands and home maintenance and taking care of elderly parents. And I mean, you know, the list goes on and on and on. So I really feel that people take their relationships for granted and that it's very easy to slip into bad habits. So the premise of this book is really how to awaken yourself and be more intentional about creating good habits that you weave through your day and that improve your marriage and lead to connection and intimacy and closeness. So I'm sure you've seen, well, of course, as a therapist who sees couples, as do I, we see a lot of the bad habits that come into our rooms. And bad habits can be anything from as minor as sort of eye rolling and sighing and a kind of a general low-level disrespect to outright contempt and criticism and blame and nastiness and even sort of other benign habits like spending a lot of time apart, going to separate screens at night, going to bed at different times, always having a television on during meals. So we have patterns in our lives all the time, and we may not realize how detrimental those habits can be, nor do we realize how simple it is to start integrating healthy habits that actually improve the relationship.
It's what I love about that whole premise is that you view a relationship as a kind of living organism, something that is alive and changing and very responsive to the behaviors that people lean into every day, rather than just something set, which is the common belief that a lot of couples have, that we reached a certain point and something just went by the wayside. And part of what the couples I have who have worked with the book so far really like about it is that it helps them see that their relationship is really a function of what they do every day. It's an alive thing that is very, very elastic in a lot of ways, lean into habits in a very repetitive way that then become almost calcified. But the notion that you can change things with small attitudes and behaviors every day is just it's terrific. And I'm wondering if you could
thank you.
Could you share?
Actually, what I was go ahead.
Yeah, you go.
After you. No, what I was going to say, Susan, is you brought out the concept, which I share with a lot of the people I work with, which is so valuable, I think, this aliveness that you allude to. I use the example of a plant, that the relationship is really like a third entity. There's, you know, one person, the other person, and then there's the relationship. And if you think of it as a plant, as a living, breathing plant, you want to look at, is it healthy? Is the soil dry? Are the leaves withering? Are the leaves buoyant? Are there blossoms? Is it getting enough sunlight? Is it, you know, down in a closet getting no air? You want to see how is the health of your plant. And you're also talking about really the essence of neuroplasticity, which is that relationships change based on the behaviors, just as neuroplasticity in the brain is about that the brain changes in response to new behaviors. So you just made some really good points that I try to really make clear in the book, that there is hope because the relationship is organic and always changing and has the possibility to create new neural patterns, if you will, for the relationship.
It's very empowering for couples, knowing that they're in the driver's seat in terms of making changes. And I guess I'm wondering if you could share just a few of the favorite habits that you've put down in the book that you found most impactful in your own or your clients' marriages. And I know this is a hard question. You have 75 of them. But do you have any special favorites you really love?
Well, I do have a few pet ones that are my favorites. So I guess I would start, I'll list three, because these are three of my favorites, and they happen to weave through a typical day, because that's the other piece and sort of foundation to the philosophy, if you will, of the habits, is that they're all short and they're all quick and they're easy to implement in the day. And I say that because often we might, as couples, receive information from books or therapists of different ways to revive the relationship, and it might be things like go on a weekend away or start a hobby together. And, you know, these might be great ideas, but they are typically harder to implement. They might be expensive. They might take a lot of time. And, of course, when you have something that's that hard to do, you just tend to not do it. So the thing about these habits is that they are short and simple and easy to do and therefore more likely to be done. So that's kind of the philosophy that underpins all of them. But the three I'm going to tell you about are basically to do in the morning, the end of a workday, sort of an average weekday workday, and the end of the evening. So the first one I'm going to mention has to do with actually saying goodbye to each other in the morning. There's also one when you first greet each other, but I'm going to do this one because this is really the launch and the landing. Launch meaning launching out into the day and saying goodbye to your spouse. Landing meaning coming home at night. And that the transition points of the launch and the landing really, really matter. And yet, we often take those launches and landings with just total complacency, take them for granted, don't even notice them, sort of a, bye, honey, have a nice day, and a, hi, honey, I'm home. And they lack any sort of real meaning. So the one that I recommend for the launch or saying goodbye is called So Long Farewell. And it's basically to really intentionally go up to your mate, look at them in the eye, and then I suggest a gesture where you're putting your hand on your heart and you're reaching it out toward the other. And it's a gesture of, you have my heart, or my heart is with you, or basically a gesture of, I love you. Now, this may seem very simple, but when you do it with intention and you catch their eye, and if they're doing it back to you, you just have this really sort of magical moment of knowing that you're connected and that you basically have their heart as you go on through the day. This one I especially like, Susan, because I do a lot of work with grievers, as you know, and my first book was Transcending Loss, and I tell you, I've worked with so many widows and widowers through the years, and their words are so poignant, because frequently they will say, oh, you know, I didn't know I was going to say goodbye then. I didn't know that would be my last time to see them. I wish it had been more meaningful. I wish I had said I love you. And there's this sense of almost regret or a wistfulness. If I could only have one more minute with them, if I could only have one more hug. And so, you know, when you combine that sort of sense of, wow, you know, every time you say goodbye to your beloved, you really just don't know. You can't assume that you will see each other again in a way. So I'm kind of holding the reality of mortality as a way to awaken and highlight the importance of saying goodbye to this person, that it needs to have meaning. So again, using this gesture of open-heartedness and connection, and both of you recognizing this poignant moment of saying goodbye. So that's So Long Farewell. The landing is to have when you reunite, because hopefully you are able to reunite at the end of the day, and that is to have a full body 20-second hug, a reunion hug. And I call this one puppy love, and it came out of the idea of how so many people will greet their dog or cat or pet with this amazing affection, and usually it's because that animal is just demanding it of you. They're so excited to see you, and they're wagging their tail, and they're jumping on you. So to use that sort of just exuberant affection to reunite at the end of the day with your mate, because here you have reunited. You both did survive the day. And 20 seconds is an incredibly long time to hug. It's beyond what feels natural. And yet, it's exactly how long it takes to release oxytocin in your bloodstream. And oxytocin is the bonding hormone that makes us feel connected. So to have this sort of reunion hug where it's just full body relaxing into each other for 20 seconds, it really creates a climate of connection and affection.
Clients, so, you know, love that. They initially, they find it corny and they're laughing, but then what they notice is that there really is a change. And I've invited them to recognize that it's the same hormone that gets produced when a mother is nursing with a baby, the mother and the infant. And there's some research that would indicate that there's an oxytocin bath between the person petting a dog and the dog. So you're kind of the same benefit as what we naturally give to our pets and to our infants, and clients end up loving it. It's there's such mindfulness around it, and it becomes very sweet. It starts out feeling corny to people, but they end up loving the sweetness of it.
Yes, and it can also feel very awkward. And
yes.
So I advise people just stay with this process. Just hang in there. And if you could sort of sigh and just let your body relax into each other, there's also a sense of just safe harbor. You've come home to your sanctuary, to safe harbor. And then the third one that I really like to end the day with, I call it Thanks for the Memories. And it's to basically end your day by thanking your partner for something they've done in that day. And what this does, Susan, is it creates, basically it trains yourself to look for things that you're grateful for as opposed to things that you're annoyed by, which are always far too easy to notice. And it also creates a climate of appreciation, because I think couples really have, I would almost call it an epidemic of underappreciation. It's like we just have this chronic need, I don't know what it comes from, but to underappreciate our partners. And so to have this habit at night of both training your own mind to look for things that you're grateful for and then sharing it with your partner so that they have a sense of being appreciated, it's a beautiful, mindful way to create a moment of goodwill. And goodwill like that starts to cascade. It has a contagious effect where you just start feeling better. So I really like that one as well.
Oh, absolutely. And what it does is counter our negativity bias. I think people drift so naturally toward complaints and peeves, and it really trains people to think about, why am I here? What is there about my partner that I love and appreciate? And clients already have reported feeling seen around that one, feeling acknowledged and appreciated and seen, and that's so important. So those are three really good ones.
It's what we long for, too, I think. We just have this innate longing to want to be seen and want to be witnessed and want to be held and appreciated. And I like the word intimacy, which I've heard broken down into me see. So intimacy is into me see. And that when you're that transparent and that, allow yourself to be viewed, there's something very sacred about having your partner seeing you in your full authenticity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I want to remind listeners, we have some listeners on the phone, that if you have any questions, feel free to interject. Just dial 1 on your phone and you'll be in line to join us on the air. Well, I would like to, now I'm going to play the devil's advocate, okay?
Okay.
I just love the simplicity. I love the simplicity and the groundedness of the ideas. And as I said, the couples I work with have enjoyed the fact that these habits are so easily integrated into their lives without cost or much time, just mindfulness and intentionality. But I'm wondering about couples, and I found myself thinking about this as I was reading the book, couples who might not from the practices in this book or might not be appropriate candidates for these habits. And the reason I ask that is that the book seems to presume a rekindling or a maintaining of connection, communication, and intimacy behaviors which normally manifested in the beginning of a marriage. What if the initial bonding or premise of a marriage was faulty or toxic? Can those couples use these habits with any success, in your opinion?
Well, I think that is a very important question and very valid. And it's true that in some ways the book is geared for people who either are already starting out healthy, like newlyweds. I think it's a great book for new couples, newlyweds, to just sort of cement good habits right off the bat. And I also think it's great for couples who basically have a lot of goodwill towards each other and still have a strong foundation of love, but they just may be feeling off kilter by busy, busy lives and feel like, you know, they're just swimming downstream and they can't quite get back to each other. So it's really helpful for those clients and you know, readers as well. Now, the kind of people that you might be describing where they have some really entrenched negative patterns or even super toxic, you know, I guess I would say that really in those instances, they need to have some level of de-escalation before they're even going to want to do these habits. And in general, that's where people like you come in, Susan, or me, when we're working with couples to try to de-escalate some of that hostility and that, you know, deep, deep hurt. That said, I would say that there's still something really important about doing your own work. And as you know, we often see couples who they come in and say, you know, point the finger, it's all his fault, it's all her fault, you know, he's doing it all wrong, she's doing it all wrong. And I would say, you know, you really have to look, hold the mirror up to yourself and see what are you bringing to the table. And in those instances where people really do want to continue to draw together, sometimes one person can do habits and just sort of do them almost for themselves. When I say that, I mean for their own peace of mind, for their own open heart, for their own sense of well-being, that they know they're doing everything they can to be loving and open and giving. But then there's a final category that you've alluded to, which are maybe there was a false premise to the marriage to begin with. And I will say that for anyone who's read this book or read part of the bio, they'll recognize that Daniel and I are in a second marriage. We're both secondly married and both divorced. And so I'm certainly one of the first people to say that divorce is not, it's not an impossibility. In fact, sometimes it's the best outcome. It's the best outcome for two people who are just really unhappy together. So I'm not a marriage preservationist in the sense that all couples, if you've gotten married, you've got to stay married till the day you die. I just obviously don't believe that because I've gotten divorced. And however, I will also say that I don't see those marriages as failures necessarily. I think that some marriages run their course. Some marriages have a very important purpose. Maybe it's to have children or to do some important growth together, but then they run their course and it's time to part ways. And so I'm a big believer that that's a possibility as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. What you're talking about is the fact that, for couples who are very embroiled in a lot of toxic stuff, obviously there needs to be a de-escalation and reduced toxicity before there's a clear enough path to see what level of value there is between each other and how much goodwill can be amplified. But I do think what people like about the book so far is that it's empowering for one person. I mean, you began in the beginning saying, yes, it takes two to tango, but one person alone can change the direction of the dance. And I think for couples who feel like they're inevitably moving toward divorce, I have never met a couple that felt okay doing that without leaving no stone unturned. And this really allows people to take individual responsibility to see, well, is there anything that I can change on my own? And, you know, hopefully, is there anything left, anything that can be kind of grown or rekindled? And sometimes, sometimes not, but people generally feel better when they do that exploration. You're right. You know, I work with those couples, too, where they're just so toxic for each other. There's no experience of any value in each other or respect. Gottman's Four Apocalyptic Horsemen, Predictors of Divorce. And sometimes it's just too late, but it doesn't hurt to explore possibilities, and this is a great way to explore.
Well, and not only that, but it may be too late for the marriage, but chances are you're going to have an ongoing relationship, and especially if you have children together. So I also try to help couples, even if it turns out that they're going to separate and eventually divorce, I'm a big believer in a peaceful divorce, and that it does not have to be a world war. It does not have to be bitter or, you know, acrimonious. That people can really start to see each other as important people in their lives, and perhaps co-parents with children, and just someone that you care about, you have a history with, even if you choose not to remain married to them.
Yes, absolutely. Now, this next question is kind of related. I don't know if it'll feel redundant, but I was thinking about couples really stuck, and some couples I've worked with who are stuck in contempt, rage, and blame. And because the book seems to presume a motivation to connect based on some history of mutual valuing, respect, and caring, I'm wondering if there's a point at which you would feel that there's too much damage and loss of goodwill to effectively use these habits. Is there something that you would recognize that would be a kind of sign to you that this book may be contraindicated for those couples?
Well, you know, I've had training in the EFT model, which is emotionally focused therapy for couples that Sue Johnson created. And really, the premise of that philosophy is that when someone is that rageful or that blaming, that it's really a kind of protest behavior to an attachment injury. And basically, that just boils down to the fact that we all want to, we are wired to attach, we want to attach, and in that we want to feel that we matter, that we're important to our partner. When we, to the degree that we don't feel that, we kind of throw tantrums, as it were. We have this protest behavior where we act badly and we accuse and we blame and we lash out, which, of course, gets us exactly the opposite of what we want, which is to feel attached. And so it's this vicious cycle, really. It's sort of heart-wrenching to see it when all the person wants is to feel important and to feel attached, but everything they do creates exactly the opposite of that. So sometimes if you can help people go underneath the rage and underneath the blame and sort of really connect with that deep desire to attach and to, if the other person, if there's enough safety, emotional safety between them where that other partner can hear it and start to understand what's really going on under the surface, sometimes they can find their way back to each other. So there is a section in 75 Habits for conflict, for example, and one of the habits is called peekaboo, which is basically that very thing, to what's going on underneath this? What can I hear differently? How are they being hurt? Or what are they trying to really tell me? So, and there are quite a few other conflict designed habits that might help people who are in the harder stages of dealing with each other.
Okay. You know, obviously slowing down, de-escalating things, and encouraging curiosity and listening.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the problem for some couples, though, would be that if people just have felt so brutalized by each other, they feel so defensive, they've lost curiosity. And I don't know, maybe the answer to my question is that for those couples, maybe first doing a piece of individual work to take some ownership around what's coming from where, and then revisiting, you know, just kind of de-escalating things and calling a truce initially with certain behaviors. So that they might be readier down the road.
That's right. And I think, you know, it's very easy to just want to point the finger at what our partner's doing or not doing, and I think that that gets us into trouble, and that the couples that end up in the end doing the best are the ones where each partner can really own their own contribution, what they're bringing, what they're not bringing, how they're behaving, how they're reacting. And so to the degree that you can do your own individual work and really be curious about yourself and your own contribution, that can really make a big difference to the couple.
Absolutely, absolutely. Ownership, very, very important. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm wondering, again, we have some more listeners on the line, and if anybody wants to ask a question, feel free now. Otherwise, I'm just going to keep asking Ashley questions, and we'll be just talking. But just if you want, and we can bring you on. I'm thinking about some couples I've worked with, Ashley, and here in this issue I'm presenting. Can the habits designed to enhance connection and physical intimacy be effective, you feel, for partners who are asexual with each other, no longer feel physical attraction, may feel more like siblings, or I'm thinking about one couple I worked with recently where one partner just hated being touched, literally hated being touched. So like the slow dancing habit, I could not imagine this guy even trying that. It was just too intimate.
Right.
So I'm wondering about spouses and also spouses who don't like their partner's bodies anymore or dislike the way their spouses move. I was thinking about some of the habits in the book to enhance, physical connection and telling your partner you love their body, embracing their body as it changes through time. Would you mm-hmm. think that these habits would be contraindicated for those couples?
Well, certainly not all the habits are physical. So I think that's why it's nice that there are 75, because they won't all appeal equally to every couple. And as you
right.
know, couples are so individual and have so many particular nuances. It's kind of like 12-step programs when one of their mottos is, take what you need and leave the rest. So some people will really resonate with some of the more action-oriented habits, and some people will really resonate with some of the more visual and sort of internal-oriented habits, and some will love the physical habits. I mean, in general, I think that, we're not only wired to attach, but we're wired to touch. And barring a really traumatic childhood situation, we really do respond well to touch, and it's something we long for and typically find comforting. But obviously, as you know, some people really just simply don't like touch, and if they've had a high trauma, sexual abuse, it could be really loaded. So every couple has to work with what feels right to them. Sometimes it's a matter of working with the partner to create safety, to have boundaries that need to be respected and worked with. I do think, though, that couples who end up more as siblings, there is nothing wrong with that if that's what both of them want. I mean, again, it really, every couple is so individual, but when you find things that work for you in whatever way that is, then that's a plus, as long as you're both sort of on the same page. It's amazing what a wide variety of situations are out there, from couples having, sex once a week or daily, to once a year, to never. And again, we tend to hear the idea that sexual activity is a barometer for a good and close relationship, and often that can be the case, but it really has more to do with what both of you are comfortable with and what both of you have negotiated and feel good about. It's a very different situation if you both want different things, and then it's a matter of being open with each other and really negotiating it.
Yes, and working selectively on other aspects of the relationship that then shift the culture so it becomes a more benign, loving culture can sometimes just open up possibilities that didn't feel like possibilities before. There have been a number of couples I've worked with where the last thing they could imagine was intimate contact, but they could see working on just creating a friendlier atmosphere of goodwill and appreciation and seeing where that went.
Exactly, and you'd be surprised where it leads, because it just, in general, opens your heart more and makes you feel more inclined to be kind to the other person, and when that kindness comes, other things just open up. Then you want to give them a hug. I mean, even, as you were saying, a sibling relationship, typically, if you have a good relationship with your sibling, you want to hug them, you want to be nice to them, you might even, hold their hand a little bit and just... You feel warm and tender towards them.
Absolutely. Now, Ashley, there are a few habits that I've gotten particularly positive feedback from some couples around. I wanted to share this with you. The ones designed to stimulate safe communication and positive experiences on a date seem to be very effective in avoiding the usual conversation minefields that people get into and in amplifying love. I've worked with a number of couples over the years who they plan these dates and then they get out on a date and somebody starts talking about money or the kids. That's one of the favorite things my husband and I do. We'll get in the hot tub, which is just a lovely, sensual, terrific experience outside, and then we'll start talking about work issues or money differences, and it's almost like a joke now because it's a prescription for a very bad hot tub experience. So we had to finally, after, I don't know, 6 months of it, say that's going to be part of our 500-yard rule. So, you know, one of the ones that I really love is that 500-yard rule, that when you get 500 yards from the house, You have an agreement not to discuss sex, money, or the kids, the big, you know, the big triad of stressors. And it really, couples report that it helps them feel really safe. But then they get into, so what else are we going to talk about? And I love the fact that you, one of the habits is through the years, I think you call it, where couples reminisce and they re-evoke memories of positive experiences, and you know, they hold it in mind. It reminded me of your little anecdote about the guy looking at the picture on the plane and holding the memory in mind for a certain amount of time, bringing up very positive feelings. Couples love that. It gives them something very benign and positive to talk about, and it reminds them, why are we even bothering to go out on a date? So it's great.
That's right.
The boundary. Yeah. And
well, I'm glad you mentioned that one, because that is a fun one. And you know, I think of that as kind of playing tongue in cheek with the idea that we often have of be in the now, and there's a lot of, you know, sort of philosophy of how important it is to just be in the now, and that that's a path to peace, sort of Eckhart Tolle philosophy. And yet, I say, forget about it. Don't be in the now. Go in the past. Think about some wonderful times from your past. Just go down memory lane together, basically. And sometimes I advise people to go year by year, and depending on how many years they've been together, and they sometimes will get a kick out of it. They're like, I can't remember 15 years ago. But you'd be amazed. They really can. And then other people aren't that formal. They'll just sort of, you know, oh, do you remember when? And, oh, do you remember when? So some people like a little more structure, or they might go by vacations. Let's think of what vacation we went on in 2002, and then let's think about what vacation we went on in 2003. So people can really go with how their memories work and how they want to reminisce. But the idea is to think of fun times they've had in the past. Sometimes it's even hard times, like when someone was sick, or maybe a time they struggled through graduate school and they were financially strapped. But they, even that is a sharing of, we got through that together. And often there are little gifts and gems to remember, even in the hard times, that create a sense of unity. The other thing I like about that particular habit is that often your partner will share a memory that either you didn't know they had, or you may not have remembered it that way, or you may have completely forgotten about it. So it's almost like a re-gift to you to hear how they experienced something and see it through their eyes and or remember it in a way that you had not remembered it before.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's an excellent point. Really, it reminds couples of why they're working on things if they're going through a hard time, too. I think it really amplifies motivation. It's so interesting. I will do an initial evaluation with couples, and I focus initially on the problems and why they're in the session, and all the aspects of the problem and what their goals are, et cetera. And at one point I switched gears and I asked them about what is strong about the relationship. What is it that we don't need to fix? And could they share some experiences that would characterize that? And I never cease to be amazed at how people's affect changes entirely, that they just kind of melt and they're smiling and then they start touching each other. And it's almost like a different couple entered the room. And it reminds me every time that there needs to be more focus on what's positive so that people can draw on that, not only in our work with couples, but for couples to build in experiences like that themselves. So I think that's a gem.
Yes.
That's really a gem.
Well, and that's really, you've just described the basis for positive psychology, which is a whole movement based on strength and what is going right as opposed to based on pathology. So it's really nice that you can help couples focus on that. And, of course, it's diagnostic for you, too, because if they really can't think of anything that's going right, it sort of tells you something about where they are.
Absolutely. The new wiring habit, I think, is terrific. The introducing novelty into a relationship and how novelty stimulates dopamine and all the feel-good chemicals. Couples really like that they can make an adventure out of that, not to go to the same restaurant or the same hike or the same lake or whatever, but to I encourage couples to take turns surprising each other if they like surprises. And so one week it'll be one person's turn. The next week it'll be another person's turn to introduce either a new food at dinner or a new walk or whatever, a new drive. And couples love it. It's a sense of discovery together.
Yeah, that really is nice. And we need new experiences so that we break out of ruts. You know, the other one that I really like a lot in the sort of dating section in the book is called Dream On. And, again, this is another not being in the now, but talking about your dreams for the future. What do you dream will happen in the next year, 5 years, 10 years? And so instead of looking backwards, as we do with the memory one, this is looking forward. And you know, it's interesting, when couples are first courting and meeting each other, there's a lot of that sort of dream talk. And if you're, you know, in college, it might be, what do you want to be when you grow up? Or it might be, where do you see your career going? Where do you see yourself living? Do you want to have children? How do you envision your life? And then as those things start to happen, we forget to dream together. And it may be as simple as, you know, where do you want to go on vacation next year? But it could really be a sense of, where do you see the future? Do you want to retire? Do you want to live in the South? Do you want to travel? Do you want to be an expatriate? Just allowing each other to dream together, because we often forget to do that.
Would you add some qualification to it so that it doesn't become a hook for criticism? In other words, I'm thinking about couples where one person started talking about their dreams and the other one would say, yeah, sure, the snowball's chance in hell of doing that with the way you've been going, you know, with all your smoking or the way you're managing your health. We're never going to get there. Mm-hmm. You know, I could see that one eroding very quickly unless there's some kind of an agreement about not going toxic.
Yes, that's right. And allowing it to be a dream and not necessarily even could happen. It could almost be a what would we do if we won the lottery kind of dream. Just you sort of almost have to suspend disbelief in a way. That it's more of an exercise in, really kind of pie-in-the-sky dreaming. And so it's not meant to come down to, well, how do you think we can ever take that trip when you won't save any money? And, you know, it should not come down to a practical battering session. It's really just to understand with each other that this is just dreaming.
Right. And it's just an expression of one's heart, learning about each other's heart.
That's right.
Now,
and seeing where their fantasies lie.
Yes, absolutely. So, in other words, if it's left in the realm of fantasy, and if anybody starts getting into logistic land, nix that really quickly. This is not about logistics and concrete things and logic.
Exactly.
Really about understanding each other's hearts and sharing fantasies. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about the habits for couples in conflict. I think they're so important to the repair process. Couples so often discount. I never cease to be amazed at how couples see conflict as the problem and not the way they engage in repair. And what I love about these habits is that they raise empathy, they amplify common ground, they reduce reactivity, they enhance personal responsibility, and they get people out of their amygdala, basically, out of the reptilian brain. And, you know, the code red, calling a 15-minute timeout for oneself or one other if one starts to get very charged up.
Yes.
The through and, you your know, eyes the, only to the one about the deep breathing when things get really ramped up and switch roles so that you don't polarize, do the left switch.
Yes. Yep. And you know, one that I've had a lot of success with couples, they really seem to like it a lot, is the teamwork sign. And that is basically once an argument or discussion has come to its completion and you're basically trying to do the repair as you're discussing, it's to have a gesture that's known just to the two of you that indicates we're in this together. And so people, you know, I get them, I mean, they surprise me with their creativity. But the idea is to have some sort of gesture or touching or sign to each other that we are teammates. And so this really heightens that we're not adversaries, we're friends, we're on the same team, we're doing this together, we're not enemies. And just to have that kind of visual cue to each other, it's really amazing how powerful that can be. And just a reminder to yourself and to your partner and to each other that you're on the same team.
It's also very intimate if it's part of your private language.
Yes, exactly. And there's something very endearing about having a private language with someone. So the more that you can have sort of secret signs and gestures and words, I think that's a really great habit to develop.
There were a few favorites of mine. I really I like the half full habit where you're kind of moaning and groaning about your partner and you're feeling very resentful or angry or annoyed at your partner, and you begin reframing your reframing from your partner as a problem to your partner as part of the solution, switching the frequency in your head about what am I focusing on, and what has my partner done for me? I think you in that one asked three things my partner has done for me this week to kind of change.
Yes, it does. It really flips your perspective, and that's based on a really interesting Japanese psychology technique that's called Nikon, which is it's pronounced Nikon like the camera, but it's spelled Naikan. And that is this idea of asking questions, and the three specific questions are, what has my partner, you're thinking, what have they done for me lately? But the Nikon question is, what have I done for them in the past day, hour, few days? And then the other questions would even be to go further and say, what difficulties have I caused them? Because, again, usually we're totally into thinking the difficulties they've caused me.
Yes.
So it's this shift in perspective of saying, what have I done for them? What have they done for me? And basically, what trouble do I cause them? So it's kind of playing in your head with different ways of looking at the giving and receiving that occurs in a relationship, and not just thinking about what they don't do for me, but what do they do for me? What do I do for them? And what trouble do I cause them? Not just what trouble do they cause me?
Yeah.
So it's a fun way to kind of shift.
It interrupts.
Yeah, it interrupts the pattern. That's exactly right. Because we all get into those negative spirals, and we're looking for ways to interrupt the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Susan, I have to tell you, I'm so impressed by how well you know the habits. It's fantastic.
Seeing them, I've been using some of them on my husband.
Great.
He's a bit of a pig with some of them and seems to respond very well. He doesn't even know what's happening. He just knows I've been nicer. And and he's nicer, and it's much sweeter between us. I mean, we have a lovely relationship anyway, but and I'm encouraging clients to use them and getting a lot of interesting feedback. For instance, the take two around conflict, where 24 hours after conflict, do a 10-minute review, focusing on your own behavior, what you noticed about your own behavior, and I think in that one, it's what you could have done differently. And I have one couple in particular who noticed that they started to get back into a blame cycle. Well, I did that, and that wasn't too great, but if you just had listened to me and if you hadn't done X, Y, and Z, everything would have been fine. And they found that they needed to maintain discipline about the focus on one's own behavior, the ownership as part of the repair process. And once they could get that, it was they felt it was magical. It really diffused the whole thing, and it ebbed away. It wasn't just another drop in the endless well of resentments.
That's right, because you really are asked to look at what could I have done differently? What might have happened if I had said this instead? So it's really about taking that ownership and accountability.
Absolutely. It really diffuses the conflict, and I just think the ones around conflict are so particularly critical, because people tend not to, in my experience, take ownership of it's easier not to take ownership of one's own part in the conflict. We're all experts about how our partner can be a jerk, but it slows
right.
things sufficiently and shifts the focus onto oneself. And what I say to clients is, you're the only thing that you can change. Your own behavior, instead of focusing on trying to move the mountain. People love that empowerment.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing is that I think often couples will feel like arguments are just this terrible thing, and it drives them apart, and it, you know, undermines their connection. But it does not have to be that way, because, in fact, conflict, once it's de-escalated enough where it's not nastiness, where it's really more of a sense of discussion or discovery, it really can help you understand yourself better, understand your own needs, understand your partner's needs, understand them. I mean, it's just it's a process of discovery and understanding. So I really try to help shift that idea that conflict is all bad, but that it can help people grow together and heal. Because I think the relationship with one's mate, one's partner, one's spouse is like none other. It's spiritual, it's physical, it's emotional, it's sexual. And you can be close to other people in your life, but to have that level of intimacy potentially with a mate, there's just nothing else like it. And you get to do so much work together that can help you heal, that can help you see the world differently. So those discussions are just fraught with a richness that can really lead to some great growth.
I think that's the whole educative process for couples, helping them recognize that there's actually a developmental stage they reach where conflict is more, it's just more natural. It's inherent in that stage as they discover that they're not joined at the hip. They're two separate people who may want and like and need different things. And it's a normal part of their growth as a couple. And for couples to have tools to help them negotiate that terrain, I think is really terrific. This is why, Ashley, I was I was in one of these tuxedo rental places 2 weeks ago. My son was a groomsman in a wedding. And I was thinking, your book, you should have stacks of your book piled all over these places where people are getting married. So that, you know, just a little hint. Down the road, you're going to need on the front end so you know what you're in for. You're not ignorant, and you know that there's help. And there are things that you can do to negotiate the terrain of a developing relationship. What do you think? You think maybe
that's
you want to hang out at places like that?
In bridal salons. And yeah, I tell you, I really think it's great for newlyweds because they just there's just a lot of information in the book from a lot of different areas in couples work to help, you know, young couples and older couples understand how to implement good, healthy habits so that you keep love at the forefront of the relationship, which is what should be there.
Yes, yes. And I don't think it will be great for younger couples, but I'm working with a couple right now in their 70s who are loving this work. Absolutely loving this.
Fantastic.
That's
great.
Together, they bought a king-size bed. They're making love. They're cuddling. They're talking. They're maintaining eye contact. It's a whole different culture between the two of them. And they didn't have to go to the south of France to do it, which is great. So,
that's a very hopeful story, isn't it? That just it doesn't matter your age. It's possible to start turning a relationship around and developing that intimacy regardless of your age or how long you've been in a relationship.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Ashley, we have just a few minutes left, and I'm wondering, is there anything else that you would want listeners to know about this new book?
Well, I guess I would just say use the habits. Read them and use them and know that they're powerful. They're small, they're simple, but they are so powerful, and they just weave a web through your day of connection. Because if you're lucky enough to be in a relationship with someone who loves you and for whom you love, you don't want to waste that. Time is too short and life is too precious. So you want to find ways to open your heart, and I think the habits help you do that. So I hope people will use them and watch the results.
Mm-hmm. I encourage couples to get two books so they can read to each other at night and share their thoughts and ideas about the book, and people are loving that.
Oh,
what also
so
is great, by the way, is the beginning of the book for cynics. In the beginning of the book, a part of what I really enjoyed about it is that you went into all the hard science that this is based on. It's not some feely-touchy, old hippie kind of stuff that's just, you know, fly-by-night.
Well, yes,
it's on science. And
that's right. And neuroplasticity.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
You know what else, Susan, is that Daniel and I, we, as you mentioned, had co-authored it and worked on it together, and we're very fortunate to be in a wonderful marriage. And yet, at the beginning, when we blended our families, we have 5 children between us, and here I thought, oh, this is fantastic. We're going to live happily ever after. I married my soulmate. But the initial blending of our families was so stressful. And for any of you listeners who are in blended families, they'll know exactly what I'm referring to. It's just very hard when you have so many other personalities involved besides the two of you. And I thought, wow, this is not easy. It's not nearly as easy as I thought it would be. And so the habits were as much for me and Daniel as for anyone that we needed to find short, simple, quick ways to stay connected. Or, you know, I mean, really, I would say that even the happiest couples will start to unravel if they don't tend to the plant being their relationship. And
yes,
it's really not a lot of work. It's just attention and habit and intention.
Right, absolutely. Well, Ashley, I can't believe it, but we're kind of at the end of the show. I want to thank you for being here with us.
Well, Jerry, it was absolutely my pleasure.
And thank you to all our listeners. Now, Ashley, for people to get a copy of your book, I think some clients already got it at Barnes & Noble, if I'm correct.
Yes.
And if not, people can just go on Amazon.
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, local independent bookstores, or you can go to my website, which is www.ashleydavisbush.com.
Okay. And if anybody wanted to contact you to work with the book, or, you know, I let our listeners know that you, you're a grief counselor and a couples therapist. Your business is Transitions and Loss Counseling, and also Couples Connect in Epping, New Hampshire.
Correct.
Their number?
Yes.
They just contact you through the website or just call you directly if they wanted to work with you.
There's a contact page on the website.
Okay. All right. That's great. Well, thank you again, Ashley. Once again, I really enjoyed having you, and I wish you all the best with this book. I think it's going to be a bestseller.
Oh, thank you so much, Susan. I really appreciated being on your program.
Okay, thanks for being here. My next episode will be on Wednesday, October 23rd at 8:30 p.m., and the topic and possible guest will be announced. So enjoy the beginning of the fall, and I'll see everybody in a month. Take care. Bye-bye.